So a few of you were here last time I rambled at the LBC, and that time I was rambling around consciousness. It's a very strange metaphor, isn't it? Rambling around consciousness. And I'm going to wander a bit further around consciousness. I'm sorry, I'm bowled over by my own metaphor. Yes, last time I was particularly focusing on the unknowability of consciousness, if you remember. That you cannot make consciousness conscious exactly. Consciousness cannot be an object of consciousness. If it is an object, it's only an object in reflection. I can think of consciousness, but of course I'm thinking about a thought, not consciousness itself, if you see what I mean. I can only be conscious, or consciousness is simply there. I'm aware. There is awareness. So I was descanting a little, cadenzaing a little on the theme of consciousness along these lines. And this time I want to explore a little bit in the same direction, but a bit more structurally, as it were. I've been particularly struck quite recently by a very important phrase from the Pali Canon. I know there are people here from who've been coming to the centre for a long time, and I know there are some who've come very recently. So let me just explain very briefly what I mean when I say Pali Canon. You know that the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, and you know that he taught extensively in northeastern India, around the areas that now are known as Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, and even as far as Delhi. He wandered teaching everywhere he went. And a lot of what he had to say was consciously remembered. And after his death, his discourses, as they're sometimes called, his communications were remembered and handed on orally. They were handed on orally for 300 or 400 years. No written record was taken. And a quite systematic process of remembering what he had to say was kind of institutionalized. But, of course, it wasn't as simple as that. And in the process of remembering and passing on to others, it was subtly changed and language changed. Different people remember different things in different areas. So the Buddha's records of the Buddha's teaching orally spread out in different ways in different areas. But a particular collection of the Buddha's sayings, a very extensive collection of the Buddha's sayings, were handed down and preserved in Sri Lanka. And they were written down in a language now known as Pali. Pali is roughly the language that would have been an immediate descendant of the language the Buddha himself would have spoken. And of course it's a relative or an ancestor or a great-great uncle or aunt of many modern Indian languages such as Hindi, Gujarati, Marathi, Bengali, Odissi, and so on. Even Kashmiri and Afghani and so on. So the Buddha's teachings were preserved in Sri Lanka and handed down, written down, and now form the basis of the schools known as the Theravada. And they are the most complete, the most extensive and the ones that we can best trace back to the Buddha. It's a quite complex issue that, but let me just leave it at that. And in this voluminous material, there's some extraordinary stuff. The great majority of which is not in use, so to speak. Its real meaning, its real significance is not really known. And even later commentaries sometimes obviously miss the point of what the Buddha was teaching. But still, the much of what he said is kept alive in the Theravada schools. There's a particular passage that I'm going to call on, which is only found in one place, but which is extremely important, and in the commentaries don't seem to fully make sense of it. In the Mahayana schools, which are the schools of northern of Tibet, of China, Japan, Korea, etc., a school developed which did make sense of what this passage says. So I'm going to try over these 3 days to explore that passage. It's just two verses, two short verses, and what they mean in terms of the Yogacara school. I'm not going to give you a very technical and scholarly assessment of that school. I'm trying to give you an understanding of what its significance is for us, which is bound to be somewhat oversimplified. But I'm going to try to draw out what that school has to say on the basis, perhaps, of what the Buddha said in these two verses. I'm going to try to show what that says about us and our minds, our consciousness, our awareness. So, this is the quotation. Luminous is this mind. Luminous is this mind. But it is defiled by adventitious defilements. Adventitious means added on. Agantukehi in Pali, which is, I think, is a word found in Gujarati and Marathi and Hindi. So, luminous is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. That's the core statement. This mind is luminous, but it's been covered over. It's been covered over by defilements, impurities, you could say, that are added on top of it. Very, very important. The first verse goes on to say, the uninstructed worldling, the asuttava puthajana, I'll say more about that in a moment, the uninstructed worldling does not understand this as it really is. So if we're uninstructed, and if we're puthajanas, that is, we're simply caught up with the business of getting and spending, then we don't understand this as it really is. We don't really understand that our minds are actually luminous, but covered over by defilements that are added to them, as it is, yathabhuta. For those of you who know a little bit of Pali. Therefore, I say that for such people, the uninstructed worldling, there is no development of mind. Because we don't understand the nature of mind, we don't understand that our minds are really luminous, but covered over by defilements that are added to them, we cannot develop our minds. We mistake what mental development means. That's what this first verse says. The second verse reproduces fundamentally what the first verse says, but puts it in more positive form. Luminous is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. My arm's not quite long enough. The noble, the well-instructed, the well-listened, noble disciple understands this as it really is, and therefore, for him or her, there is mental development. So if you understand this as it really is, then your mind can develop. Citta bhavana. Your mind can unfold. You can realize your mind fully. So this is my text for these 3 days. I'll see if I can make it last. It's very simple, isn't it? Maybe that's enough. So let's just dwell a little bit upon the literal statement, and then we'll start to unpack it and go into it more fully, and maybe even explore a little bit about what it means for it to be defiled, how it comes to be defiled. The first thing is, this mind is luminous. Pabhasanang idang chittang. Pabhasanang means radiant, shining, yes, luminous. It's a metaphor, of course, although perhaps it's a metaphor chosen with a particular aptness, appropriateness. It doesn't work if you can't see, for instance. But for us, for most of us, consciousness is very strongly associated with light, with the visual medium. Of course, it's not. If you can't see, then it's more to do with hearing and so forth and kinesthetic sense. But the luminosity of mind has a particular sort of cogency in communicating to us its character. Mind is radiant. Mind illumines the world. We're all sitting here illumining the world. The world is lit up. The objects in our visual field, at least, are illumined by light. But of course, it's not meaning luminous in that sense. It's as if the light is shining from within us. That's the metaphor. The light of consciousness illumines the world. It lights it up. It's a metaphor, but don't forget that. It's not to be taken literally. Because we cannot talk about awareness in any other but than metaphorical terms, as we've already seen. We can't really say anything about it that is factual. Because consciousness is what illumines the world. Consciousness is what does the knowing. Consciousness is what does the sensing. It's not itself possible. It's not possible to make it itself into an object. We can infer a lot about it. We can metaphoricalize about it, but we cannot dissect it. We cannot weigh it. We cannot measure it. We cannot tell its color. So, luminosity is used here as the most apt metaphor for the character of consciousness. It lights the world up. It's extraordinary, isn't it? We're all of us lit up. We're all of us turned on. All of us sitting here. The one thing we know that we all are doing is illuminating the world. We're all lighting it up. We're all aware. In a way that is so natural to us. It's more natural than our breathing, you could say. More fundamental to us than our breathing. The fact that we are aware. And there's almost nothing we can say about it, apart from in reflection, in its objects, in how it illumines. But the subject itself, the consciousness itself, is not susceptible of direct analysis, because it's what does analysis. But we're all doing it. We're all luminous. But that's not how it feels. Frankly, brothers and sisters, it doesn't feel like that. Often the mind is beclouded, and beclouded especially emotionally, and it's beclouded by confusion. We're so tangled up with the objects of our awareness and the complexity of our relationship with those objects and the complexity of our relationship with their relationships to each other, that it feels anything but luminous. It feels dark, it feels complex, it feels bewildering, it feels even painful at times. And it seems as if the nature of the situation of awareness is such that there's nothing you can do about it. It seems like a given that you can do nothing about, with all its complexity, all its complication. But this text is saying, no, It's not like that. The mind itself, if we could only experience mind itself, or allow the mind to be what it is actually luminous. What happens is that we pile on top of that kleshas, defilements, kileshas in Pali, poisons, complications, confusions, kleshas, those things that becloud the mind, that narrow it down, that reduce its infinite luminosity, and that confine its natural beauty, its natural joy, that confine it down to the painful strictures of the kleshas that we add on to it. And this is the perspective. But those kleshas are adventitious. Advent means they arrive. Agantuk in modern Indian languages is applied to a guest who just turns up. Traditionally in India, of course, you're supposed to feel that they're very, very welcome. But, you know, people just turn up and they are the agantuk guests. They weren't invited, you didn't expect them, they just turn up. And there's a whole section in the Vinaya, the monastic code, to discuss what you do about the monk or nun who turns up agantuk. Of course, you must treat them extremely well. If they turn up at your centre, you must make them very welcome. But the point is, they're not native to the place. So the kleshas are not native to us. They're not part of the structure of mind, as it were. They're added to it. They arrive on top of it. And they muck it up. They becloud it. They besmirch it. You know, often the images you've given of a mirror, a beautiful, brilliant mirror, which is then covered over with dust or dirt, and that therefore does not reflect accurately whatever is placed before it. So that metaphor, and beware of the metaphor, because metaphors always have a back and a front. They have what they're trying to communicate and the literal interpretation which confuses what they're actually trying to communicate. But you're all very alert to the nature of metaphor and poetry, I'm sure. So the mirror just reflects. But when it's beclouded by dust, when dirt is smeared upon it, it doesn't reflect accurately. It distorts what is reflected in it. So our minds are like that. The kleshas, and we'll see later what we mean by the kleshas cloud the mind. So the Buddha says that people who haven't been instructed, in other words, people who haven't been along to the LBC and done a basic beginner's course and so forth, and who are worldlings, in other words, who are just involved in the narrow business of getting along in life, which is quite a time-consuming business, and just think in terms of making the most of this interval between birth and death. They don't understand the real nature of this awareness, which is so deeply characteristic of them, which is them, ultimately, you could say. They don't really understand it. And they get involved in the kleshas. And they respond from the kleshas. They respond to the kleshas in others. And they make a real tangle. We make a real tangle, not just them. We make a real tangle because we don't really understand the nature of our own consciousness. This radiant consciousness that is natural to us. We don't understand that the kleshas are added to it. We take them for real. We take them for ultimate and fixed. And in a sense, we even become attached to them. It's astonishing how attached we can become to our own suffering and the causes of our suffering, and how we can even cultivate it and develop it. So because we're uninstructed, in other words, we haven't heard the teachings of the Dhamma that show us the real nature of this situation in which we are, the real nature of the mind that illumines the world, we're just caught up with it all. So we can't develop the mind. If we start thinking about developing the mind, we don't understand what the mind is, then what we're going to do is just complicate the kleshas, if you see what I mean. We're going to take hold of the kleshas and sort of work upon them and make them more complex still. All sorts of different ways of doing that. We can do it by literalizing our experience. Literalizing our experience in all sorts of ways. Thinking that there's a real self. Thinking that there are gods out there that really exist in some ultimate sense. And so on and so forth. There are all sorts of ways in which we complicate the situation because we don't understand what it really is to be awake. And we don't understand that the defilements, all the causes of our suffering, are added. They're not native to us. They're not natural to us. On the other hand, the instructed, the suttava, Arya Savaka, yes, I'll just say what that means. Sutta means to hear. The one who has heard. So that the one who has listened to the teaching. You could, of course, read it, but at that time people didn't read. The Buddha was probably illiterate. So the metaphorical language of learning was listening. It's quite interesting in a way, because listening in certain sense is more direct. Yes, the one who has heard and who is a follower, a savaka, and a noble follower, Arya. Arya, the dreaded word, Aryan, comes from, in the Buddhist context, means noble in the sense of having living in accordance with the highest values. That's my parsing of it. That the noble ones are those who have realized the significance of genuine values and live in accordance with them. That's an interpretive expression. So those who have heard the nature of the mind and understood it and lived in accordance with it, formed their lives on that basis, they make real citta bhavana, real mental development, because they know what they're doing. They know what they're working with. Their work is fundamentally to remove the kleshas and to realize the luminous nature of the mind, to open up to the mind's natural radiance. Very, very brief summary of what the whole teaching is about. Removing the defilements, the obscurations that distort the world, make it difficult, if not impossible, for us to see things as they really are, therefore to act on the basis of illusion, therefore to suffer. But if we can see, even theoretically, not just theoretically, but a little intuition of the mind's natural luminosity, and recognize the character of the kleshas that defile the mind, then we can begin to work. Then we can begin to unfold the real nature of our minds. And by clearing away what stands in the way, there's a lot of clearing up to do, brothers and sisters. My goodness, what a lot of clearing up to do. It's not a simple job. You know, it's nice, isn't it? Subhuti's told us what to do, just get rid of the kleshas and let the mind shine. If only. You can get some feeling for it, and you can even get some intuition of it. Maybe even in just sitting here before we started, you just get a little glimpse of the mind's natural radiance. But very hard to rest in that, because the kleshas arise out of habits that we have been cultivating systematically, thoroughly, and even with malice aforethought, the Buddhist tradition says since beginningless time. That's quite a long time. Since beginningless time. We can't get back to the point when there was just luminous mind and we thought, I think I'll add some kleshas to that. It's not like that. It's a metaphor. Don't get over metaphysical about it. But we've been developing, or we've been working on the basis of these kleshas, and by working on the basis of these kleshas, we've been heaping up kleshas upon kleshas. So it's a lot of work to do. A hell of a lot of work to do. Let's not put too fine a point upon it. We have to do a lot of work just to clear away these habitual patterns that we've been acting on the basis of, and through our acting on the basis of them, recreating them, developing them further under the principle of karma. Through our actions, we act on the basis of our kleshas, our misunderstanding about the nature of our minds, the nature of the existential situation. We act on that basis, and acting on that basis, we simply deepen the problem, or at least perpetuate the problem. Ad infinitum. Since beginningless time. And according to classical Buddhist teaching, our present existence is the consequence of us having done that before. The mind that we have now is the mind that we've been developing in the past on the basis of our past misunderstanding of the nature of mind and our previous kleshas. There it is. Sorry, that's the way it is. But here we are. We're hearing the Buddha. We're hearing the Buddha telling us the nature of the situation. We are now suttava. We have heard. That's it. We've heard the nature of our minds. We've heard that our minds are fundamentally luminous, but that on top of that, luminosity, or beclouding that luminosity, there are these adventitious defilements. So this is what we're going to be investigating further over these days. How should we do that? I hadn't actually planned this far. But I suppose we can go back to the equipment that we've got. We're all here with all the equipment that's necessary to take this further. We're all awake. Yep, everybody's awake. We're all aware. We've all, in this situation that is being described, we've all got what it is that's being talked about. We've all got minds. If you haven't a mind, then you're not listening to me. We've all got minds. We're all therefore the subjects of these two verses. We've all got minds that are naturally radiant, but that are covered over by defilements. So it's very difficult to know how to sort of proceed. But let me just sort of suggest that you, even now, and certainly later, just sort of start to investigate overnight this possibility of the luminosity of mind, sort of almost turn it over as a kind of conundrum, a koan in the Zen sense of a phrase that is evocative, but whose meaning is not immediately apparent. What does it mean to say the mind is luminous? this mind is luminous. Pabasanang idang chittang. Idang means this. Chittang means mind. This mind is luminous. Not some other mind. This one. The one that we are now illumining the world with. That is lighting up the world. So perhaps just sort of remembering that what we're talking about is our own consciousness, our own awareness right now, we can just sort of toy a little bit with the metaphor of luminosity, of radiance. You imagine the radiance of the sun, very easy today. Imagine the sun that is just pouring out light into the world, that the sun that pours out light into the world, which then lights everything up. And one of the most extraordinary things about sunshine in Britain is that sunshine forgives everything. I came on the train a few days ago from Birmingham, and I hope nobody's going to be insulted by this, but frankly, the outer reaches of Birmingham, not the most attractive part of the world. No, nobody's getting upset. Mudita Shri is going to forgive me because her origins are elsewhere, where the sun really shines. The strange thing is, even those terrible industrial wastelands, even Fort Dunlop on the M6, becomes strangely beautiful. The sun illumines everything and forgives everything. And even the most squalid of environments is somehow made sort of forgiven, let's say, by the sunlight. We often find this in India. Even a dreadful slum, when the sun is full upon it, has a strange beauty. So the sun illumines things, and when it illumines them, it reveals their beauty. It reveals something deeply, deeply attractive about them. They begin to shine, even though superficially, even though morally, they may be far from attractive. But the sun can draw out the beauty even in the most squalid of circumstances and situations. So we're talking about this a luminosity that transcends our ordinary boundaries. You could also talk about this luminosity in another sense. I've been deep in Kant. Don't worry, I'm not going to speak too much about Kant, although unfortunately always my preoccupations become part of what I speak about. I promise not to speak about sheep. Whoops! Or LSD. Somebody asked me the other day, do you always have to have you on a contract to speak about sheep and LSD? And now I've done it again. Anyway, I've been reading Kant. And Kant has a very interesting definition of imagination. He talks about imagination as what connects interpretation, you could say, let's call it that, it's not the way he would talk about it at all, with sensory data. So, you know, we've got data pouring in upon us all the time. And we make sense of it. And we make sense of it in terms of a world. This circumstance, this situation is a synthesis, in Kantian language, of our sensory intuitions with and here I'm not going to be Kantian at all, but with our mind's interpretation. We illumine the world in terms of a specific, a particular determination. I see all of you sitting there in your spatial relations with each other. I see you with your different colours of clothes and different features of faces, your particularity, the unique particularity of every feature of my experience right now is created, according to Kant, by imagination, which synthesizes the inner and the outer. And he talks about imagination as having this sort of ordinary function, which is quite important for us to remember, that what's going on right now is not, we're not perceiving what is, if you see what I mean, not perceiving, in Kantian language, the thing in itself, which always is beyond our perception. We're seeing our construction, which is made up of the direct intuitions delivered by our senses, to accept that framework, and our interpretation, which is delivered on the basis of the particular kind of consciousness that we have. And what we perceive is a construction. It's a pretty good one. It works. Breakfast arrives. We get to the class on time. You can hear me. You can understand what I'm saying, perhaps. But it's actually an illumination. It's a sort of construction. It's a visualization, or a visualization in all the media of the senses. And Kant says that imagination is usually functions in that sort of empirical way, dealing with empirical experience, but that it can become liberated from that, and it can play freely. Imagination can play freely, and that delivers us aesthetic experience. That delivers us beauty. That delivers us aesthetic meaning. When the mind is released from the, or rather the imagination is released from the task of interpreting the world for empirical reasons, for the purposes of our everyday existence and so forth, and is free to illumine the world more and more richly, that delivers us the aesthetic experience, delivers us beauty, delivers us art, delivers us the joy of nature and so on. So perhaps this is something of what's meant by the luminosity of the mind. The mind illumines the world in terms of our construction of it, the particular picture that we create, which is, of course, related to the object in a mysterious way, in a way that we can never philosophically completely determine. But it illumines it, and it can break free from that, the strictures of the empirical, and it can illumine the world in more and more rich and extraordinary ways. So what I'm getting at now, I hope in not too long-winded and technical a way, is that right now, this world that we're creating, that each and every one of us is creating, which hopefully they more or less overlap, otherwise I speak in vain. I'll find out later what you think. But each of us is creating our own, or creating out of our own experience, a world. We're illumining the world. It's a light for us. It's awake to us. It's present for us. And it's made up of something that appears to come from outside us and something that appears to come from within us. So this is perhaps a little bit of a clue to what's intended, that the world is already illuminated by the mind's luminosity. That's just a tiny surface of that luminosity. So it's our most immediate confrontation with that luminosity. I don't know what your experience is, but I must say, sort of talking about this, you're all beginning to glow a little bit for me. I don't think it's anything in the water of London or anything like that. But in sort of talking about the mind's luminosity, my actual direct perception of the situation is slightly freed up, so that I'm more aware of the light. I'm more aware, you know, on your shiny foreheads in the slightly sweaty atmosphere, the slight shine, the slight glow that's created by the light. A luminosity, literally, in that sense. The colours beginning to become a little bit fresher. May not be happening for you, but even when we begin to explore the very immediate nature of our experience, and we begin to understand that it is an illumination, it begins to be a little bit freed up, a little bit brighter, maybe. I can't tell you what your experience is, but I suggest it's worth sort of examining a little. There's some reflection of the mind's natural luminosity. And you know what happens when you get upset. Of course, you don't notice it because you're upset. But what happens is the world narrows. It darkens. It shrinks. Sometimes it can even sort of almost become as if you're looking through the wrong end of a telescope, so that the world recedes a little from you. If you feel particularly sort of a bit alienated from people and because you're upset or you're feeling uninvolved or even distanced, it literally becomes distanced. So the kleshas even change the nature of the immediate illumination of the world. They literally change our immediate experience of it. Although in ways that we usually don't notice, because we're so caught up with the feelings that are involved. We're so caught up with those strong impulsions that go with the kleshas that disturb our perception. So we don't notice the mind's luminosity because we're so caught up with the consequences of our construction of the world. I'll say much more about this later. But what I want to invite you to do over the next 24 hours is try to play with, so to speak, this luminosity. Play with the fact that the world is an illumination, is a construction. You can play with it quite literally if you've got any interest in art, for instance. If you know how to draw, you know that when you draw, you have to get out of your literalized idea about your experience. You have to just look. When you just look, you begin to experience more of the luminosity of the situation. When you really just listen to what's going on, not immediately constructing it in terms of your interpretations and so forth, but just listening to the sounds, listening to the deeper qualities in what you're hearing. You hear something. I don't know what the auditory equivalent of luminosity would be, but you're experiencing the sort of echo, you could say, of the mind, the mind's echo, and so on. So one, in order to experience the mind's luminosity, you need to switch into a different mode of experience in which you let go to some extent of your constructing of the world. And you just watch, you just listen, you just smell, you just feel the kinesthetic motion. You're mindful in that sense. And when you begin to do that, you pay attention to this theme of luminosity and see if it has any meaning for you, see if it has any, it's illuminated for you. So, I hope that I've given you a broad introduction to the topic. I hope I've at least given you some approach to what is meant by the mind being luminous. I hope you've got some feeling for what is meant by the adventitious defilements, the defilements that are heaped on top of it and that construct it and constrict it. And I hope you can begin to see why, if you don't understand that, you can't develop your mind. And why, if you do understand that, you can develop your mind. And I'm going to go into this much more fully tomorrow. I'm going to give you a sort of model of how this process takes place, how the mind's luminosity appears in every moment and then is covered over in every moment by the adventitious defilements. Every moment, the mind emerges fresh and clear, and then immediately, in a moment, in the twinkling of a moment, is covered over by defilements. Moment by moment, that's happening. It's not something that happened and then stopped, as were frozen, because you couldn't get out of it, it was. But moment by moment, the mind emerges luminous and then is constricted and constructed. So we've got a few minutes, and I'm told that I always speak too much and don't give enough time for questions, which is just a new excuse to talk more. But let me just see if there's any questions that have arisen from what I've said so far. Anything that's not clear. I may not be able to make it clear, but let's see. Yeah.
You've talked about the cancelling of mind and that certain roles for the imagination and perhaps other structures of mind help to automatically form our experience. And that gives us something to share in a shared world as a subject in a shared world. That thing that we all do seems to allow us to share reality. Is that a cliché? Is that something that eventually we need to let go of? Or is that something else? Is that something that we isn't bad in that sense?
Well, it's a very complex question. As somebody always says when they don't know how to answer. It's a very complex question because there are dimensions of that that are simply natural to us as organisms with eyes and, you know, optic nerves and whatever goes on inside there, which Glenn can tell us all about. You know, the processes that go simply with being an organism of this particular kind. And those are, you know, the Buddha has that too. So the world appears to the Buddha, constructed through the medium of the senses. So it's not that, it's not the actual act of construction is the problem. The problem is that we don't understand what is going on when that happens, and we take too literally our features of it. We'll see much more clearly what this means tomorrow. But yes, it's important not to think that we've all got to stop, you know, living in the world and go into a flash of light. Well, that might be quite nice. But and of course, it's arguable that the Buddha, when he enters parinirvana, when he loses this physical body, he stops doing that. What actually happens after that? He said it's not possible to recount in terms of our language, which is constructed out of that world of experience. Does that get anywhere near what you're getting at? It there are layers to what's going on, and we'll look at those layers in the model that I'll talk about tomorrow, the Yogacara model. But yes, it's not that we should stop the basic level of construction. That's going to happen, whether you like it or not, so to speak, because it goes with having an organism with nerves and neurons and so forth and so on. It's just going to happen. The problem is that we don't know what's going on.
Sure. Being different to a film or to my friends and things like that. And I can see that being to see the sort of the deeper level of the reality of how things are. But I sort of I'm sort of curious about how, for example, as a creative person, how the importance and the difference of those perceptions is what creates different kinds of artistic interpretation of the world as well. And sort of I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the validity of different apprehensions of reality, because if we all had the same sort of fundamental experience of reality, then we wouldn't have those aesthetic interpretations. Does that make sense?
Yes, I'm not sure what to do with that, as it were. You know, obviously we all look from different points of view. We've got different histories and even different organisms. So there are going to be subtle differences even between the constructions that we make. And, well, in a sense, that's innocent. It is simply a fact. There's a sufficient overlap for us to be able to interrelate. And what Buddhism argues that, or Buddhist tradition argues that, we actually have the possibility of relating to very different kinds of constructed reality in terms of other levels of consciousness. But I don't quite know how to link that up at the moment with the issue of creativity. But yes, of course, when people create, there is going to be something of it that is highly personal. But if the aesthetic creation is successful, it also strikes at something that is universal. So that it's the interplay between the two that is so important. I find this really interesting because I work in India for 6 months each year, and I've got to understand a little bit better the perception that people have in India and the way they look at things. And one of the things I find really interesting is they have no idea what spring means in England. You know what I mean? So certain kinds of poetry, so they're completely opaque to them. That the nearest equivalent would be the monsoon, which I shall be arriving in shortly. When the monsoon comes, the rain falls, and spring happens within about 2 hours. It just suddenly happens. So there's a difference between those perceptions that is an Indian could never have the experience of Indian of English poetry that an English person can have, and vice versa. Of course, there's dimensions to that we can share. The famous poem by Kalidasa, Meghdoot, the cloud messenger. So the idea of the cloud as a messenger between the lover and the beloved. Well, we've got clouds here, a few, and one can sort of approach it in that way. But when you're in India, you realise the significance of a cloud in a way you just can't experience it here. So I don't know whether this gets anywhere near what you're getting at. There are dimensions of creativity that are highly personal, but the more effective art is, the more universal it is. It's very striking that, again in India, so many educated people know Hamlet. They know Hamlet in several versions, in Hindi, Marathi, Gujarati, they know it, and I've heard it said that Hamlet is possibly the best known play and most loved play in Russia. So I think that there is a highly personal element to all creative activity, but there is an importantly universal, even you could say objective, if you don't put too philosophical a point upon that, element to it too. There's nothing worse than people reading your poetry, which is, with their poetry, or my poetry, which is simply about private experiences which you cannot have any approach to. They're so private that you just can't get inside them. What's really effective is when the poetry is extremely, intensely personal, and at the same time strikes on themes and images that are more or less universal. But in a way, I wasn't trying to get... My wooden leg is that I always talk about what I've most been interested in recently, and I've been reading Kant, so I inevitably bring Kant in. But I'm not really trying to get too philosophical about this. At the moment, I'm more trying to focus on the character of our experience immediately in terms of this luminosity. And I hope that that will become clearer as I draw out a model for it. But still, if there are questions that arise, I'm happy to try to address them.
Do you think that we need pleasures to sort of understand and navigate the world? I mean, we didn't have those things.
Didn't have what, sorry?
We didn't have pleasures.
Pleasures.
Had a clear luminous mind from birth and just... How would we...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in a way, you could say that you are born with a clear, luminous mind. And, But what happens is that progressively, as you mature, inverted commas, you acquire a developed personality and so forth, which is more or less dominated by kleshas in the case of ordinary people. It's possible for one to be born and for that not to happen, as is the case with according to Buddhist tradition, with stream entrance and beyond. But perhaps what you're pointing to is the difference between simply having a pure and luminous mind, which might mean that you are just a baby, if you see what I mean, taken too much drugs, just completely spaced out. I met people like that, just completely blissed out, can't operate within the world, as it were. And that is not what we're trying to achieve. We're not trying to achieve a sort of luminous blob. What one's trying to achieve is the awareness of the luminous character of the mind and the disentanglement from the kleshas. The disentanglement from the kleshas doesn't leave you incapable. I think it relates to the same sort of point as arose over here. Maybe again we'll see this a bit more later. The Buddha had completely extinguished the kleshas. That would be one way of describing the Buddha. The Buddha is one who has no kleshas. But the Buddha is still able to get up in the morning, have his breakfast, go on his arms round, put on his robes, and have conversations with people. There's a very important little phrase in the again Samyutta Nikaya where somebody asks the Buddha, you know, you say that to be an awakened one is to go beyond self-clinging. I'm paraphrasing heavily. I hear you and your disciples all the time saying I and you and we and mine and so forth. I'm going to prepare my arms robes, robes. I'm going to get my arms food. So what's going on? Have you dropped it or haven't you dropped it? It's heavily paraphrased. Please don't look for the exact quotation. And so the Buddha says, well, yes, I've seen through that clinging to I. I know that the sense of a self is a conventional construction, that it has no ultimate reality. It's a linguistic convenience, and I use it simply as a linguistic convenience so that we can interchange. But I have no attachment to it as ultimate. So what one is aiming at is that sort of state where you've experienced the luminosity of the mind. You've seen through the kleshas. And insofar as you choose to, you remain active within the world, particularly trying to help others to wake up to their true inner beauty, you could say, their own inner luminosity, their own freedom. So you remain able to use the currency of the world and to use this body, but you attach no ultimate significance to it. You know that there is no I, ultimately speaking. It's an empirical construction. This is one meaning of what I was saying yesterday, those of you who are present, about the Buddha serving the Dhamma. So the Buddha, as an empirical being, so to speak, with the sense organs and the nerves and the neurons and so forth, constructs a world just like everybody else. But he puts that at the service of the Dhamma. The Dhamma, you could even say, equates ultimately to the mind's luminosity when fully realized. He puts himself at the service of that because he can't stop being an empirical self. But that is no longer interpreted as ultimate. Does that make sense? But yes, this used to be a big issue around in the 60s. We all thought that if we became as little children, we'd done it, and we made a pretty good go of it. In other words, just sort of abdicating the fullness of one's human consciousness, if you see what I mean, and trying to become almost irresponsible, you might say. Yeah. So this all has to be interpreted in those terms, and that's why it's important to see both parts, the mind's luminosity and its being covered by adventitious defilements. It's only when you get... In other words, if you interpret the mind's luminosity wrongly, that itself is a klesha. That itself is a delusion. But I hope it'll get clearer as we go a little further into it. But it's good that these issues are at least arising at this stage, so we can see whether they're dealt with at the end. Oh, I think that's it, is it? Yeah. So if you're, if you can, please just try to sort of reflect on this. Even just say to yourself, this mind is luminous. And just try to see what that does for you. And try to just reflect a little on the defilements as defilements that are added, not as intrinsic. If they were intrinsic, you couldn't get rid of them. If the defilements were part of who you were, they would be permanent, and it would simply be an eternal life of suffering. But they're not, they're added. So just try to reflect on that, and tomorrow we'll try to see at least a model of how that process works in this moment. Thank you.